racism, classism, and the enduring lessons of a classical American novel. Harper Lee's 1960 Southern Gothic novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, has become a classroom staple and the subject of countless literary and sociological analyses. The book has gained even more attention of late in the build-up toward the release of what's being dubbed a sequel. I'm Keith Shortall, and on this edition of Maine Calling Book Club, we revisit To Kill a Mockingbird. We'll talk with a panel of analysts who mostly share an appreciation for the novel and its historical significance, but take different views on the current relevance of the book. We'll talk about the themes of racism, classism, of judging others based on appearance and social standing, and on the book's message that people are basically good. To Kill a Mockingbird, today on Maine Calling Book Club, and some reaction to today's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act. First, this news. But first, as you may have just heard, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a key part of President Obama's Affordable Care Act.
After multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. So today is a victory for hardworking Americans all across this country whose lives will continue to become more secure in a changing economy because of this law.
The justices voted 6-3 that the nationwide tax subsidies that are granted to millions of Americans do not depend on where they live. Joining us now to talk about what this means is Emily Brostek of Consumers for Affordable Healthcare. It's an advocacy group that supports the Affordable Care Act. Emily, welcome to the program today and joining us on such short notice.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be here.
So what does this decision mean, first of all, for Maine?
It means it is great news for Maine. The Supreme Court today has confirmed what we already knew. Premium tax credits through the Affordable Care Act were always intended to help consumers in every state afford health insurance, no matter whether the state was running its own health insurance marketplace or if they handed that responsibility over to the federal government. So as President Obama said, the ACA is the law of the land, and this is another attempt to take it down that has failed.
So the challenge was on the subsidies. What would have happened had this gone the other way?
If this had gone the other way, it would have been devastating for Maine. In Maine, nearly 70,000 people enrolled in a plan on the marketplace this past year, and nearly 61,000 of those people got a tax credit that made that plan affordable. Those tax credits are a lifeline for people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford coverage. And if we had lost this Supreme Court case, those Mainers would have been in danger of losing their coverage and then losing access to the care that they need to stay healthy.
Is this the end then? We heard the president say, intimate that it's this is the end of those challenges, of the challenges. It's the law of the land. Indisputably now, does that mean that there are no further obstacles for the law?
There do continue to be some threats to the Affordable Care Act working its way through the courts, but I think this is the beginning of the end. It's really time for us to all begin to work together, opponents and proponents of the law, to improve our health system. The ACA is here to stay, and it's time for us to roll up our sleeves and finish the work of ensuring that Americans get the health coverage and care that they need and deserve. And in Maine, that includes accepting the federal funding that's available to cover people with low incomes, which we haven't done at this point.
All right. Emily Brostek, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Emily Brostek of Consumers for Affordable Healthcare. We'll have more on this story also in a special edition of Here and Now at 1 o'clock after this program. Few books over the past half century have garnered the critical and public acclaim of Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, deemed by some second only to the Bible on the list of books that have made a difference. The novel tells the story of a small-town Southern lawyer, Atticus Finch, and his kids, Scout and Jem, as told by the adult voice of Scout. There are two storylines in the book, one focused on the mysterious neighbor, Boo Radley, who is seldom seen, but imagined into a kind of boogeyman by Scout and Jem and their friend Dill. The other is a court case in which Atticus is appointed to defend a black man, Tom Robinson, accused of raping a white woman, Mayella Yule. Despite a convincing defense, Robinson is found guilty and is shot while trying to escape from prison before Atticus can launch an appeal. Writer Harper Lee never released another book, but a sequel of sorts, a manuscript that she began before To Kill a Mockingbird, is scheduled to be released in a few weeks, an announcement that has become somewhat controversial in some circles. With me in our studio today, Sandra Thompson. She's an English teacher at Sanford High School. Anthony Walton is writer in residence at Bowdoin College and the author of Mississippi, An American Journey. He's also the editor of the Vintage Book of African American Poetry, among several other books. His poems, essays, and journalism have appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, among other journals and magazines. And Ron Schneider is an attorney with Bernstein Shure, who specializes in employment and healthcare law, but has practiced criminal defense as well. He has a BA in English from Bates College as well. As always, we want to hear from you. When was the last time you picked up a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird, and what do you remember about this book? Give us a call. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email address is talk@mpbn.net, or you can tweet at Main Calling or post to the Main Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Main Calling today.
Thank you.
As I said at the top, some have considered this second only to the Bible in terms of a book that really made a difference. Many people cite this book as their favorite book. Sandy, let's go to you, because you not only enjoy the book and like it, but you teach it yearly as well.
Yes, I do, actually. I teach it every year because I want to, not because I have to. And every year the reception is the same from the students. It hooks them first. There's the adventure. The characters are relatable and wonderful. The mystery, there's loss, there's love. But once they're hooked on that, there are so many layers that the students are able to access. There's the narrative voice of the adult scout that overlays the telling of the story through that limited perspective and point of view of her as a child. But also the themes, I think, are relatable today as they were then. I mean, certainly it is a story that deals explicitly with race. But when you look below the surface of that, that is a contextual specific that is less about that and more about the universal and timeless themes, what it means to stand up for what you believe in, the best and the worst of human nature, loss, love, innocence, empathy. I think Atticus words it best in his closing statement when he's talking about Tom Robinson, and he says that this isn't an issue of a particular race, but it's an issue about the human race. And I like to approach it that way. And I say that it is relatable now as it is then. And every year I teach it, I think the students get something out of it that they can apply to themselves.
Okay. Ron Schneider, what's your take on this? I know that Atticus Finch is often upheld kind of as the example of what attorneys should be. You've been a defense attorney. And I might have read somewhere that you said how to get Atticus Finch to friend you on Facebook or something like that. What's your take on Atticus Finch as attorney?
Well, as an attorney, the great thing about the book is that the life of an attorney and the job of an attorney is presented as noble, in a noble profession. It's not a criticism of him. He stands up for an individual who is innocent, which is, quite frankly, the hardest thing a defense attorney can do, is actually stand up for the innocent because of the threat of conviction. But he's taking on a task that's unpleasant, that nobody else wants to do, and he does it even though he really thinks he's going to lose. And that's ennobling, and that's a positive view of what it means to be an attorney. And quite frankly, his closing argument is exactly what an attorney would like to be so eloquent in the closing, is to be plain speaking, but at the same time not talking down to people. It's just a wonderful depiction of what an attorney is.
So when you were in law school and you shared this with your friends, did they look at you as a bit of an idealist?
No, everyone goes to law school as an idealist.
It's That's what happens there. That I right. guess
you learn later that you can't change the world.
yeah. Anthony Walton, what's from your perspective the significance of this book? I guess in terms of the way that it addresses some of the themes that Sandy pointed out.
Well, I'm sorry. First of all, I fully agree that it is a beautifully written book. It is an incredibly realized book. When you read page to page, the characters in particular, the way that they are realized on the page, it's amazing, and it's beyond well done. The concerns that I have about the book have more to do with how we see it today, the kind of context. Sandy mentioned context, and I think that the way that she's discussing it, I think that that's true. I'm coming at it from a different context, looking at it through, let's say, a different lens. And I wonder if the book, which in my opinion usually ends up being discussed in terms of race in America and is often students' first introduction to the discussion of race, sometimes it can be students' only encounter with the discussion of race during their time. I wonder if the book is complicated enough. The poet Seamus Heaney said that we have to always search for images and symbols that are adequate to our predicament. And I think that at this time in the United States, in 2015, I just have questions as to whether the book is adequate to our predicament at this moment.
It's interesting that they were going back and preparing for the show, looking at reviews at the time and since. And on the one hand, describing the book as layered, complex treatment of characters that sort of displays their own conflicts, where we can even be empathetic to those who are making the wrong choices. On the other hand, other critics dismissed it as overly simplistic, that these were simple characters trying to, paint or portray these issues in overly simple ways, including criticisms by her colleagues, writers at the time in Southern fiction. So I'll ask the other panelists, what do you think of Anthony's take on that and this notion that it's actually overly simplistic and maybe not what we hold it up to be necessarily?
Well, I guess I would address that as saying that you really can't be too simple when you're dealing with hypocrisy and human nature and what makes us all human beings. Teaching this to ninth grade students, they tend to be a bit self-focused anyways. So the context definitely is a bit of an eye-opener to understand that the world we live in is not the world that has always existed, and to approach it like that, and then to look at the little nuances of the novel and to see the little things that people have to stand up for. Atticus being discussed as being the same person at home as he is on the public streets, and the misconceptions of Boo Radley, and judging people before you know them, and being able to walk in their shoes, whether or not you agree with their beliefs. And even people that, for example, one of the very minor characters, putting on a front of being an alcoholic and I'm trying to think of his name. And now
Dolphus Raymond.
Yes, Mr. Dolphus Raymond. Thank you. Just to help ease the discomfort of other people, you know, sacrifice. These are things I think that young adults today really aren't exposed to. So to say it's simplistic is perhaps true on one level, but to see these little acts of nobility and strong moral character in characters of the book is accessible to them in a way that's less grandiose than just seeing someone stand up in a trial for a man that is being wrongly accused, which is really not something that they're going to be able to relate to, and that's the way we approach it.
Ron?
I also think that I did something and listened to the audio tape of the book again for about the third time, and you pick up things sometimes when you listen to it. But I listened to the issues of the way the Finches and other people actually adhere to the code of the time. Cal is a part of the family, but she's called Cal. She calls Jem Mr. Jem. She sleeps on the couch on a cot in the kitchen. When she takes the children to church, you see the difference. There's actually a scene at the courthouse square when Dill and Scout are talking to Dolphus Raymond, where Dill's upset about the cross-examination of Tom Robinson, and Scout's reaction is, and her statement is, well, he's just a Negro. So even within these people who are supposedly believing in some form of equality, they really are applying and adhering to the code that was racist. So there is a little bit of complexity in there, but it's subtle. You have to actually listen to it. Scout actually is concerned that at one point that Calpurnia is going to the front of the Radley's house to warn them of the rabid dog, and she says she's supposed to go around the back.
It is true that it seems, apart from just this theme of racism, this other theme of the pressure in at the time in small town Southern life to play along, to go along with this. Is it apologetic almost to it, or is it trying to expose it, or what's your take?
Well, I think that one of the wonderful things about the book and about the narrator is that Harper Lee does not try to make Scout or her family or friends more than they were at that time. So I think that sense of verisimilitude is part of the power of the book. But I also then, and this is part of what I mean about context, there's a strong undercurrent in the book that is related to, shall we say, Scout's limitations as a narrator, her point of view, what she can see and understand, that implies that African Americans don't have agency, that they are just almost completely victims. There's a little bit of what we might call magical Negro-ness of that African Americans are better, you know, that they, you know, Reverend Sykes, Calpurnia, they kind of go above and beyond in the service of the whites. And some of that they had to, but it's also a little bit, I would say, pushed. But one of my premier things is that when young people read this book, I wonder if their visions or views of African Americans are distorted and they are seen as less active, less powerful, less willing to act on their own behalf than they actually were even in 1935 or 1905 or 1835.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll get your reactions to that. We want to listen, want to hear from you listening. Also, the number to join us is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Broadcasting's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Sweetser, seeking mentors to support children with mental and behavioral health needs. Training and support provided. Learn more at sweetser.org.
This week on Morning Edition, covering the aftermath of the massacre in Charleston.
We need to come together, and I don't think just packing the church pews is going to be enough. We need to get out in the streets.
The conversation around Charleston and trying to understand a tragedy. Listen again to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition weekdays from 6 to 9 here on MPBN Radio. MPBN's members make public radio possible here in Maine, and we appreciate gifts of support at all levels. The Beacon Society was established to thank and recognize those members whose annual gifts reach $1,200 or more, or about $100 a month. If you would like more information about joining the Beacon Society, we thank you for your consideration. Please call MPBN at 800-884-1717 and ask to speak to Scott Marshallden. And thanks.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the Maine Calling Book Club reconvenes to discuss Harper Lee's classic To Kill a Mockingbird. With me in our studio, Anthony Walton is writer in residence at Bowdoin College and author of Mississippi, An American Journey. Ron Schneider is an attorney with Bernstein Shure who specializes in employment and healthcare law. Sandra Thompson is an English teacher at Sanford High School. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. We're going to go to Leslie now, who wants to share some information about an event coming up. Hi, Leslie. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi, Keith.
How are you?
Good. I'm great. It's a beautiful day.
I know. And we're all inside with the curtains drawn, but yeah. Such is the nature of radio. What can you tell us about this event?
Well, I'm calling from the Patent Tree Library in Bath. And I was very excited when I heard this morning that you were going to be talking about To Kill a Mockingbird this afternoon, because we are doing a community read this summer in partnership with the local bookstore, the Mustard Seed Bookstore down on Front Street. And with all the discussion and controversy about Ghosts at a Watchman coming out in a few weeks, we decided it was a good time to just have a Harper Lee festival. So we're starting with To Kill a Mockingbird, and we're having three events coming up in July around that. And then after people have time to read the new book, we're going to resume with activities in September.
Great. Sounds very interesting. So, and that's, again, where is it?
The Patton Free Library in Bath.
In Bath.
Uh-huh.
All right, great. Well, thank you for sharing that, and I'm sure interested people will move along your way. I wanted to get the other panel's response to Anthony's assessment before the break. Sandy, you're wrestling with us a little bit.
I am. I'm not really sure how to address that. As far as the honesty with the portrayal of African Americans in the story, I guess I would say that I wouldn't throw the book at someone and ask them to assess it on that as its merit only. Definitely a lot of care has to be taken to deal with the context of the novel. It can definitely even be a discussion that can be relatable today. I mean, things have certainly not been magically fixed in our society. But also, the fact that certain other topics are brought up, even the brief conversation with their teacher and Hitler, and there are other hints throughout the novel of other groups of people being treated unfairly, past and present. So I think that approaching it with that point of view is that there are always going to be people in our society that want to mistreat and hurt people that have done no wrong or do not deserve it. And what kind of person stands up for, even if arguably they haven't done an absolute fantastic job of taking on the civil rights movement, but as Atticus has been argued to not have done, but within the constructs of the society that you live in, what makes something okay and what makes it not okay to do to another human being? And I think that that would be the way that I would address that.
Let's bring in a call here to Jean in Green Lake. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Jean. I'm calling from Green Lake.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Well, I'm so glad that you brought up Calpurnia in the book, because every simple character in that story, although very complicated, becomes important as you grow older. And as a young white girl raised by a black woman, when Calpurnia said, "Jean Louise, if that boy Walter Cunningham is a guest in your house and he wants to eat up that tablecloth, you're going to let him," when Walter poured that syrup over all of his food. But, different people are important in your lives, so teaching you manners and morals, and I just love Calpurnia.
Yeah. Anthony, let's talk about Calpurnia. As a character, is she overly simplified, or does she play a role that you think could be improved or made more real?
In a perfect world, a perfect book, a book that was about Calpurnia, I think that you would see much more roundedness, you'd see much more complication. I mean, part of the problem, and I think that this is part of what Sandy's talking about, in any well-realized book or novel, you're going to run into limitations. Now, in the book as it stands, Calpurnia, I think, is a good character. I think, from my experience, it's not quite rounded enough. She's, let's say, a bit perfect from my judgment, and I would say from having aunts like that, you know. So
you want to see more flaw.
Yes, and more of her, I don't want to say dark side, but just a fuller sense of her as a person rather than as a person in service of the Finch family or in service of the plot.
And I would say that I think that that's a good point. There's only one chapter where you get any real glimpse at Calpurnia's other life when she takes the kids to the church. But I think it was actually the problem with Calpurnia that inspired the I'll Fly Away series on National Public Broadcast or TV. And even that character, I can't remember her name, but the idea was to present somebody with a family of her own. We don't know much about Calpurnia. We find out that the Zeebo, the trash man, is her son, but that's sort of a discovery as well. But even I have to agree that with the presentation of the characters, Atticus is paternalistic. Atticus sees the black people as victims. He doesn't necessarily see them in any kind of complex way either. When he says it's a sin to cheat a black man, he's actually somewhat robbing them of any independence or autonomy, because it's, if you cheat them, you're trash. And that is a complicated issue, I think, in the book.
Let's go to Bob in South Portland. Hi, Bob.
Boy, I'll tell you, thank you for taking my call, because I totally disagree with what that gentleman just said. I just reread, I hate to say this, but I might have read To Kill a Mockingbird for the first time a week ago, and I'm in my 50s, so I'm kind of embarrassed. The movie was so spectacular, and somehow, when I was in school, I do not remember that we read this book, and that's shameful. But anyway, I completely disagree about what that gentleman just said. I think the two guys, I don't know what book they read, but, you know, keep in mind that this book is told from the perspective of Scout, who is 8 to 9 years old during this book. So you're not going to get this incredible analysis from an 8 and 9 year old girl, and some of her naivete and innocence comes through in the book. I think Harper Lee could not have been more perfect in writing this book from Scout's perspective. How many books are written from a perspective of a little girl to begin with? As far as the flaws that weren't presented for Calpurnia or some of the other wonderful characters, the book is how many pages? 200 and something pages, 300 pages, excuse me. What Harper Lee did was to portray how trapped everybody was, both the Negroes, as black folks were called in the South at that time by people with dignity, and the white people. And I don't think at all that Atticus was paternalistic. What he meant by that, and again, I just read this last week, according to my perspective, is black people are already in a box. White society has already put them in a box. We're holding them prisoner. To then further take advantage of them is even more sinful. So I just don't... I'm really disagreeing with much of what I hear the guy saying, and it's interesting that you have a wonderful woman there, teacher, and Scout was a female, and the woman on your panel seems to be more in tune with what the book actually speaks to. And I finished this book, And it's powerful. I have to urge adults out there, if you think that you're getting the full effect of To Kill a Mockingbird just by seeing the movie, it's a wonderful, fantastic movie. Please read this book. It's just so moving. I looked at Atticus as just a wonderful guide and teacher for his kids. And there's things that don't make it into the movie, and one of them that I wanted to mention, Miss Maudie Atkinson, I think, if I have that character correct, she was one of the many racist neighbors that they had. But because Atticus was an adult, unlike Jem, who was, I think, 12, and Scout, who was 8, Atticus saw people beyond just if they were racist, that part of their life. So Maudie Atkinson was a really grumpy lady neighbor and berated these cute little kids, Atticus's kids, and yelled at them about what Atticus was doing defending this black man. But yet Atticus, who was aware of her being a grumpy old lady, made Jem read to her for the last, what turned out to be the last month or two of Maudie's life. She was dying from cancer, and the kids didn't know that. Atticus did.
And Bob, I'm sorry, we're up against the break. So
that was actually Mrs. DeBose. That's Mrs. DeBose.
Yes.
Maudie was the next-door neighbor who made cakes for the kids and actually was very supportive of Atticus. Yeah.
Okay, but Bob, real quick, finish up.
Yeah, I just think this is a perfect book. I'd compare it to kind of like The Perfection of Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, and I think this is why Harper Lee never wrote another book, because I don't know what else she could have done. This is a gift to the United States and the world, and everybody should read this book.
I guess we'll find out shortly with this other book that's coming out on July 15th. Okay, we're going to have to take another break, and I'll let you respond to Bob's comments there. But I do want to I know this is heresy, but I want to go out into the break. This is a clip from the movie, just because it's radio. And this is a scene. This is the lynch mob scene at the courthouse where a crowd has come to get Tom Robinson. Atticus is there trying to stop them. He's outnumbered. And then the kids, Scout, Jem, Dill, show up against the wishes of Atticus. But something happens there, which I guess I might describe innocence overpowering hatred and mob mentality. But here's a condensed version of the clip.
Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one early morning, remember? We had a talk. I went and got my daddy to come out and thank you. I go to school with your boy. I go to school with Walter. He's a nice boy. Tell him hey for me, won't you?
I'll tell Walter you said hey. Let's clear out of here. Let's go, boys.
All right, we'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments, 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Roosevelt Campobello International Park, now open and taking reservations for Tea with Eleanor at fdr.net. By Casella, converting landfill gas to electricity. Committed to providing clean, renewable energy for Mainers. Casella, giving resources new life. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com.
On the next Fresh Air, ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten takes us to the Colorado River, the most important water source for nearly 40 million people in 7 western states. They face a water crisis, he says, in part because officials promised more water than the river could deliver, and some still pursue policies that promote waste and discourage conservation. Join us.
That's coming up this evening at 7 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Next time on Living on Earth, humans are changing the world, and so birds are changing their tune.
What was surprising is if you go higher in elevation on the exact same mountain, The birds low down on the mountain sing different songs than birds higher up on the mountain.
Chemicals, noise pollution, and other ways were affecting the birds. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Join us this Sunday at 7 a.m. here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine Calling Book Club is discussing Harper Lee's classic, To Kill a Mockingbird. With me in our studio, Ron Schneider. He's an attorney with Bernstein Schuer and has a Bachelor of Arts degree in English from Bates. Anthony Walton is a writer in residence at Bowdoin College. His poems, essays, and journalism have appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and dozens of other journals and magazines. And Sandra Thompson is an English teacher at Sanford High School. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Jane in Dresden here because she agrees with Anthony Walton. Hi, Jane. Welcome. Welcome to the program.
I tuned in quite late to this, so I'm just a little nervous, but I'm jumping in here to say that I'm in my 60s. My extended Irish Catholic family grew up in South Jersey in a very small town where racism was as thick and nasty as it was in Mississippi. And Atticus Finch was, my grandfather was an Atticus Finch. And we all read this book because we loved him, but we also learned from him and my mother and her sisters and brothers that this was a very limited perspective on race. And when I reread the book, I began to understand that it kind of conveys that a man tries to do something good for a black man, a white man. It doesn't turn out so well, but at least he tried. That's sort of the narrative. I also want to say I agree with the other caller that it is the point of view of Scout, and that's a limited 8 to 10-year-old point of view. The dynamics around race then and now were so complex that most people, most white people, cannot even begin to wrap their arms around them unless I found they were involved in the civil rights movement or they lived in South Jersey where they saw the day-to-day beatings and castigation of black students like I saw in the high school that I went to in South Jersey. And once you experience that the violence and the unfairness yourself, you then can begin to understand race. And when you see it happening, little articles until about a year ago saying, oh, this man was killed in Baltimore, this one in Philadelphia, you start thinking, why is this still happening? Right. And to me now, To Kill a Mockingbird is a challenge for white people to begin to look at the old version and try to understand what is really happening now and how we as white privileged people feed into this. Well, we tried. We did sort of a good job, but it didn't work out so well.
Jane, thanks for calling. I'll go to Anthony Walton, who hasn't had a chance to respond here in a while.
I would thank Jane for her comments. Going back to the previous caller, I think that as a discussion of race in 2015, the book no longer works. Now, I think part of the complexity of what we're talking about is what Sandy is talking about, which is different. And I think that that points to something that perhaps this book is a young adult book. And perhaps that's a way that we can begin to look at it and think about it. I have come to think of it as a kind of fable. It's a book that teaches a very important moral lesson. It teaches a number of important moral lessons. It is comforting to read, even as an African American. It's comforting to read. Now, going to the scene that you played from the movie, which is also, it's extended in the book, Now, the problem, and this is what begins to get at the complexity of all of this.
This is the lynch mob scene.
Yes. Yeah. There were thousands of lynchings in the South that Scout was not at. You know, and things went on, things had happened. I wonder how much the students learn about those, how much any Americans learn about those, think about those. If we think about what the shock of what happened last week in Charleston, how shocking that has been to all of us because of it happening kind of in real time on cable television with social media in this new globalized world that suddenly, you know, but that's not really that new of a thing in the South. And that's part of what I'm trying to say about being adequate to the discussion. And so I think that's something that we have kind of broken into here this afternoon is that To Kill a Mockingbird is a wonderful book that has very important lessons and many uses, but perhaps to use it to talk about race in the United States, which it often is used to talk about, that is no longer useful.
What would you, I'll let Sandy respond to that, but what would you, is there an example of a book that you would recommend as useful?
It's hard to say. I mean, there would be a list of books, Invisible Man, A Lesson Before Dying, Beloved. You know, there would be nonfiction books. A book that I would find very useful is Carry Me Away by Diane McWhorter, which is won the Pulitzer. It's a nonfiction book by a young white girl. It's kind of Scout doing a longer nonfiction version. She was in Birmingham during the bombings. She was a young girl, and it's written as an adult trying to come to terms with what had happened. Things like that.
Sure. Sandy, did you want to respond?
Absolutely, yes. I do appreciate what Anthony is saying, and absolutely teaching it as a race in the United States novel, I don't feel is relevant, but I do feel that, for example, going back to the lynch mob, it's not about how to stop a lynch mob and what a lynch mob is, but it's what people are capable of when they're sucked into the mob mentality, and approaching it as it's not only a black against white, black and white issue, but it's social class, it's gender, it's even religion when you compare Miss Maudie as a Baptist out in her garden with the other Baptists, as she calls them, Bible thumpers coming by and telling her she's going to help because she gardens too much. It's even looking inside the church of Calpurnia, who, yes, is a flat character, but you do need to have those flat characters to help round out the other ones. Looking at her in the church when Lula doesn't welcome Scout and Jem in there because they are not in their church. And looking at that as the ways that people exclude other people and divide each other and judge each other, that is something that is hasn't unfortunately gone away, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon. And to look at it like that, I think, is a very important reason for reading the book.
Ron?
Well, I also think sometimes when we're talking about race as a book about race, we're putting too much on the book, that this is just an incredibly well-written book. It's a hard book to read. It requires good vocabulary. You actually need to sit with a dictionary. But it's also a typical book about the struggle between good and evil. And so many books are written about that. And that's the great theme of literature. And at the end, though, the message of this author and written through the words of Atticus are that understanding that people are capable of great evil and people are capable of great good, he still believes in the basic goodness of human nature. And in the end, he says, most people are really real nice once you really see them.
Yeah.
Finally see them, he says.
A few minutes left. Let's go to Stephen in Pembroke. Hi, Stephen.
Hello?
Yes, hi. Go ahead, please.
I'd like to make a few comments. You can tell by my accent I'm not from down East Maine. I'm from the Italian inner city of Brooklyn. New York. I read To Kill a Mockingbird within weeks of its publication in 1960. I was 11 years old. I've only read it that once. It is a monumental book in my life. And I think for many people my age, Caucasian or, as Italians were in 1960, not quite yet Caucasian, it was a decisive book in motivating people in the 60s into the civil rights movement. In that sense, as an historian, I think it is an extremely relevant book, if for no other reason than to look at what was being said at that time. I think Atticus is an extremely important figure in today's world. As time goes by, the relevance of something might change. We now have a society in which probably a quarter of the children in the country are growing up in a home without the natural father or without a male father figure. And in many cases, the father becomes somebody distant who is not spoken of well. Atticus, like my father, is raising children in an extremely difficult situation. There is the racism around him. He is a single man. He is widowed. My father was not a widower. My mother was in a mental institution much of my the age of 13.
Stephen, sorry to press you here. We've got about a minute left. So,
yeah. I just want to say I think Boo Radley is an extremely important character. He is the constant. The racism whirls around, the trial, the lynch, all that whirls around us. But there is the thing that is hidden that doesn't get confronted in the open.
Yeah, and with that, we're going to have to let you go. Stephen, interesting point. We haven't spent a lot of time on Boo, but he does represent this thing we don't know about that we manufacture and turn into the boogeyman. But sorry, only about a minute left. I just wanted to say thank you for joining us. It's clear that as we move toward this release of the sequel, as it's being called, that there's still a lot of different differences of opinion about the book. But maybe you don't disagree necessarily. I know, Anthony, you think the book is important, but maybe overused to teach racism or to begin the conversation about racism.
Yes, and I would just, again, we have to search for symbols adequate to our predicament, as Seamus Heaney said. And I also think that in any discussion of books, we need to amplify and complicate. And I think that's what we've been able to do.
And the discussion, no doubt, will continue for many years to come. Sandra, Anthony, Ron, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sandy Thompson is an English teacher at Sanford High School. Anthony Walton is writer in residence at Bowdoin College, the author of Mississippi, An American Journey, and the editor of the Vintage Book of African American Poetry. Ron Schneider is an attorney with Bernstein Shure, who specializes in employment and healthcare law, but has practiced criminal defense as well. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today, and our intern Sarah Gatcom answered your calls. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith, and we had help today from our volunteer Cindy Hahn as well. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Minotaur, publishers of The Precipice by Paul Dwaran. When two hikers disappear in the 100-mile wilderness, game warden Mike Bowditch joins the search to find them.